6 people, including the gunman, died on Friday at a workplace shooting in Aurora. Yesterday, hundreds gathered in the Chicago suburb to remember those who lost their lives. Here's Reverend Dan Haas.
All of these were relatively young people. Many of them were very young people. We will never know their gifts and talents. Their lives were snuffed out. Way too short.
Thanks to WNIJ for that audio. Plus, our nation's capital can seem far removed from our day-to-day lives here at home, but one neurosurgeon from Bloomington travels there almost every month to advocate on behalf of her patients.
But as time goes on and you start to see what your patients go through, that's when you start to become very aware of the fact that advocacy is a huge part of access to quality care.
We'll hear from her and Illinois students who are working in D.C. this semester. That and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Later on today's show, we'll have more of our conversations from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And on this President's Day, we'll hear about a new exhibit at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum about JFK. But first, yesterday, hundreds of people gathered in the Chicago suburb of Aurora to honor those who were killed in a workplace shooting that happened last Friday. In total, 6 people were killed, including the gunman. 6 police officers were wounded in the incident. Just one police officer remains in the hospital. Reverend Dan Haas led the vigil in Aurora yesterday. Here, you'll hear him talk about a list of all those who have died from gun violence in Aurora this year.
We read the list of 2 other names, because every family wants us to know that we are continuing to pray for them in their loss as well. Daniel Alvarez Perez, age 18. He died on January 23rd, 2019. Nicholas Rodriguez, age 17. Died February 11th, 2019. Russell Beyer, age 47. Died February 15th, 2019. Vicente Juarez, age 54, died February 15th, 2019. Clayton Parks, age 32, died February 15th, 2019. Josh Pinkard, age 37, died February 15th. And Trevor Wayner, age 21, died February 15th. All of these were relatively young people. Many of them were very young people. We will never know their gifts and talents. Their lives were snuffed out way too short in senseless killings. And it's our commitment as a community to see that this list doesn't grow.
Thanks to our partner station WNIJ for that audio. We'll have more on this later in the hour. Stay tuned to your local NPR station throughout the day for updates on this story as well. Last week, I flew from central Illinois to Washington, D.C. It's a trip that Bloomington neurosurgeon Ann Stroink does almost every month. That's because she volunteers as an advocate on healthcare issues. Last week, she was in Washington for the American Medical Association's Advocacy Week. And when she's in our nation's capital, she visits members of our congressional delegation to talk about what she sees firsthand in her private practice, the hospital she works in, and in the operating theater. So what does an Illinois doctor do when she goes to Washington to lobby on behalf of her patients? Ann joined us while we were in Washington at NPR headquarters to tell us. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thank you so much. And Nyla, it's been a pleasure meeting you. And it's certainly a joy to talk about some of the things that I love to do.
So to be clear, you're a full-time doctor. This is something you volunteer doing.
Correct. So I'm a full-time neurosurgeon and I run a full-time schedule. But part of being, I think, a doctor is doing some of the advocacy work you need to do for your patients.
How much time do you spend in Washington then, on average?
Well, because I'm chairing the Washington Committee for Organized Neurosurgery, which is the American Association of Neurological Surgeons and the Congress of Neurological Surgeons, I'm coming to Washington about once, maybe once or once every month, pretty much.
And so you go into a congressional office. You actually visited on this trip with two of the representatives we also talked to while we were in Washington, Darren Lohood and Raja Krishnamoorthy. How much time do you get with them when you go into a representative's office?
Well, I'll also add, we went to Representative Lauren Underwood as well. So it was actually three. They usually give you about a half an hour, sometimes 20 minutes.
And how do you prepare? Because that's not a lot of time.
Well, you've got to be able to be concise, and you've got to send a clear message and not give them so much data that they don't remember it, because you can always give them a piece of paper that has the data that you might need to give them to back up what you say. But it's mostly just a friendly conversation about concerns we have about patient care.
And so what are your big concerns now? What are the major issues that you wanted to put forward? I think lots of people think, like when you said to me, well, I'm going to Washington, I thought, oh, she must be going to talk about the Affordable Care Act. But you're actually, there's so many things that you are concerned with apart from that.
Well, it's interesting because if I told you what the biggest bugaboo is in my office, it's about delay in treatment care. That isn't something that I delay or that the patient delays, but it's a interference in terms of getting approval to get a test or order some medication, or in my situation, many of the times it's just trying to get a patient into surgery for treatment of disease.
And where is that problem coming from then?
Well, it comes from insurances like Medicare Advantage and certainly private insurances that are looking at what you want to order and say, listen, we need time to think about this before we're going to give you an okay to, let's say, order an MRI scan.
And so this is called prior authorization.
Correct.
So when you were talking to lawmakers about this, how do you describe this problem to them?
Well, I usually try to start with the simple story. And it's usually some story that they've already experienced in their own family anyway. I mean, anybody who's recently been to a physician where they've had an illness that needed to be diagnosed or treated are already experiencing it. So the patient, for example, might think, why isn't this getting ordered? Why haven't they gotten back to me? And they always think, sometimes they think your office staff isn't getting things done. In reality, we're just put on waiting lists by insurance companies to get the things ordered and get it. We try to get it done in as timely manner as possible. So to answer your question, we just start out with a simple story. Hey, I have a patient I saw in my office. He has a brain tumor. And he came in with a cane because for the last week he's had progressive difficulty with walking. And I say, gosh, we need to find out what this is so that we can get you under appropriate treatment. And the way we do that is with brain surgery and get a biopsy and possible resection of the tumor. And so everything was okayed until we got the patient to the hospital. And then the insurance company said, oh, by the way, we're not paying for the image that you need to actually do the surgery. So to do a surgery where we do it stereotactically, you have to have image because it's image guidance. So you get an MRI.
So you're doing image-guided brain surgery.
Exactly, but they wouldn't approve the image. So
then you can't do the surgery.
Yeah, the patient had to go home. And so I was worried about it because I was worried that as time goes on, and because this tumor is in a very eloquent area of the brain that controls his leg, I was very worried that if this keeps going on and it gets delayed day after day, that this would really result in not a good outcome for the patient.
And so as a doctor, as a neurosurgeon, what agency or power do you have in that situation to go to the insurance company and say, hey, look, I'm saying as this person's doctor, we need to do this test. We need to figure out what's going on.
Right. And we do that. And oftentimes it's either done by a nurse calling them, or oftentimes it's a physician-to-physician conference call. And you can imagine, you know, when you're seeing patients, that's a lot of time away to get on the phone, get the doctor according to the time that they schedule it, and then you have a peer-to-peer review.
And so that's how it works with an insurance company, is you're talking to an insurance company doctor to justify this expense?
That's correct. And you always hope that the person you're going to talk to understands your discipline of medicine. Because as a neurosurgeon, I think when I talk to another neurosurgeon to explain that the tumor is sitting on the motor strip, which is the area that controls that leg, they have a better understanding. But if I am then asked to speak to a doctor that maybe has no expertise in that area, let's say an obstetrician, for example, they would have, they, you know, sometimes the communication goes downhill when you can't speak to someone who's the same specialty that you are, because they understand the consequences a little bit more clearly if they practice the same field of medicine.
And so it really is, everybody's kind of at the mercy of an insurance company.
Correct.
And so when you're telling this story to lawmakers, what's the goal? What do you want them to do about it?
Well, I want them to understand the real victim here is a patient. And so our job as doctors is not only to be great doctors, but also advocate for the patient. And if we're advocating for them, we would certainly expect our congresspeople to advocate for our patients as well. So we will sit down, tell them a story very similar to what I just said now, which is an example of many, many stories, and have them work with legislative bodies and with the government to come up with solutions to halt this problem of prior authorization and allow our patients it's about access to care is what it comes down to, timely access to care.
My guest is Anne Stroink. She's a Bloomington-based neurosurgeon. We've been talking to her in Washington about her work she does advocating for patients in Washington. And I wonder, Anne, healthcare is such a big issue. It's become a very hot-button political issue. I imagine for you, you met with both Republicans and Democrats while in Washington. I imagine you're trying to take the politics out of this, right?
Absolutely. I think the only way we are going to get any major solution with healthcare is to have a bipartisan response.
Do you feel like that exists? Is there a climate for that right now?
Well, it's odd that you say that, because I felt that this is the first time I felt that there is bipartisan interest, that both Republicans and Democrats recognize that healthcare is a big ticket item, and it's not something that's going to go away overnight, and that it's something that we all need to work on.
And when you're in Washington, how many years have you been coming to Washington?
Oh, I would guess probably maybe 15 years.
Do you feel like you have to change your message depending on the administration? Was it different? Did you have different conversations with people during the Obama years than you have now during the Trump administration?
Absolutely. I think we're obligated to understand how administrations function. You know, committees and subcommittees of the Senate and House change depend on who the majority leadership is. And so they look at things a little differently and how you problem solve. So we have to be nimble and package the message so that we understand how they work, and then we can get that message passed along better.
By the way, you were telling me something that I feel like I should let our listeners know. You were the first female resident that trained at the Mayo Clinic in neurosurgery, right?
That is correct.
Did you ever think that when you were doing that you would end up also spending time in Washington lobbying on behalf of patients?
I did not. I think when you're a young neurosurgeon, you are so clinically focused to become an expert as a surgeon. But as time goes on and you start to see what your patients go through, that's when you start to become very aware of the fact that advocacy is a huge part of access to care and access to quality care.
And I should say advocacy, not lobbying, because you're not an official, formal, registered lobbyist.
No, I'm a volunteer advocate.
And I wonder, as a volunteer advocate, as a private citizen, how has your time in Washington changed how you feel about politics?
Well, sometimes I wonder if I should have gotten involved in politics. I think I could have maybe helped move the needle even quicker. So you think about that from time to time.
And do you think about, I imagine it also changes the way you think about your civic duty and voting. You probably pay a lot more attention to it than I wonder the average citizen does.
Yes, I think so. In fact, you know, we recently reached out to all our neurosurgeons, because I think all neurosurgeons should be advocates for their patients, and I think many of them are. But we have to set that agenda, whether it's regulatory or legislative, by what we think neurosurgeons, for example, in my area, what we think neurosurgeons need for their patients. And so we very much, that's part of what I do, is encourage other neurosurgeons to become involved.
And when we're thinking about that, we mentioned the whole issue of prior authorization. What do you see as the biggest health issue that you're most concerned about this year for your patients?
Okay, so outside of prior authorization, I think there's a big evolving concern, and that is what is referred to as surprise billing. But what that really is not realizing they're not being covered for a service when they go to a hospital. And an example of that would be, Nyla, you and I have been traveling. Suppose you have a narrow network that you chose for your insurance company, and you didn't realize that when you were run over by a car here in D.C., you're going to the emergency room and you don't know if you have coverage or not, because you might have a narrow network that says, no, you're only covered by these specialists. And all of a sudden you get a surprise bill. And that's what they call it.
And sometimes these are bills for tens of thousands of dollars.
Catastrophic bills.
And you've seen this happen with your patients.
Absolutely.
And so you feel like that's another big issue that you're hoping lawmakers will tackle this year.
I will, because even though it doesn't involve everyone, because not everybody is traveling or not everyone has to go from one area to another, but the amount of those bills can real. I mean, you can be run out of your house and home over something like that. And so that needs to be immediately addressed.
Do you feel like, oh, I just had one last question for you. Do you feel like because there's been such a debate about public health care and Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and whether or not that will be dismantled in the past year or two, do you feel like the level of understanding among the general population about health care has gotten better?
Yeah, I think it's gotten a little bit better, but there's still a lot of frustrated people that just don't understand why things aren't moving in a better direction.
Are you one of them?
Absolutely.
Anne Stroink is a Bloomington-based neurosurgeon. She's in private practice in Bloomington, and we were speaking to her from NPR headquarters in D.C. Anne, thanks for taking the time to come over. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Support for WILL comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, opening its spring season with new art exhibitions at the CAM Opening Night Celebration, Thursday, February 28th, starting at 6 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What is it like to come to Washington, D.C.? People come to our nation's capital from all over the country and the world to study and work on things that matter to them. During our time in D.C., we wanted to ask Illinoisans what it's like and what they hope to do with their time in our nation's capital. We spoke with lots of elected officials. Earlier in the hour, you heard a neurosurgeon tell us why she comes to the Capitol, but we also wanted to hear from students. So we thought we'd gather a group of undergrads at the U of I, and they're living and working in D.C. this semester as part of the university's Illinois and Washington program. I had a chance to speak with them at NPR Studios in Washington last week. Austin Stadelman, Keith Jones, Ajay Jain, and Millie Johnson are all U of I students here in D.C. for the semester. Hey guys, welcome to the 21st.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
There's four of you here, but let's start with the two of you who are interns on the Hill. Ajay, you're working in Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy's office?
Yes, I'm interning in Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy's office, and he represents Illinois' 8th District.
And so you're a junior from Elmhurst. You're a political science major, but you also are studying computer science and math?
Yeah, so I am a double major in statistics and computer science and political science.
And then what made you want to – so how do you hope to use that, or what were you – how were you thinking about – how did that factor into coming to Washington?
So I've done a lot of technical internships before. I interned at JP Morgan Chase as a technology analyst last summer, and after this internship in Washington, I'm interning at Facebook as a data engineering intern. So I wanted to have some sort of different experience that I don't typically get in a technical internship, so that's why I ended up coming to the Hill. And I decided to actually combine both of my majors, because my future career that I would love to have is a career combining both computer science and political science. So, for example, doing data science or data engineering for political campaigns and helping politicians figure out the best way to get their messages across and win elections.
And so what was the first day of work like for you going into Congressman Krishnamoorthy's office on the Hill?
It was actually really interesting because I've never really taken constituent like phone calls before. So within the first hour and a half, after, you know, meeting the people on the staff, for example, I all of a sudden had to start taking phone calls.
And this is the middle of the shutdown.
In the middle of the shutdown, too. So we had a lot of angry callers talking about wanting to build the wall, or, you know, they were against the wall. And it was just really interesting. I was all of a sudden just thrown into this situation that I basically didn't feel like I was prepared for, but it took a little bit of time.
That's the very definition of an internship, I think, Ajay.
So true.
Will come back to talking to you about that in a second. But Keith, you're interning with Congressman Bobby Rush.
Yes.
How was day one for you of your internship?
Day one was pretty hectic. You know, like AJ said, answering constituent phone calls in the middle of a government shutdown is always pretty interesting as a first day intern. And so
you had to do that too.
I did. On top of that, you know, just exploring the Capitol as well, you know, it's a pretty big building and, you know, finally getting to go underground. Like a lot of people don't get to go under.
And so you get to go on the train.
Exactly.
Right. People don't know there's a little train in the Capitol.
Exactly. And taking the train for the first time, just walking around, seeing everything is kind of mind-boggling as well because, you know, as a regular citizen, you don't get to see all of that. And so it's pretty cool seeing that for the first time.
And so I wonder what advice you guys have for people who might want to make constituent calls as the person who is on the receiving end of them. Ajay, first, what advice do you have for people who want to call their congressman or woman and voice their opinions?
So one thing I recommend is that make sure that you're in the district itself, because if you don't call the right congressman, they can't exactly relate to the concerns. They can't help you out as much. There's actually a way you can look up online. If you go on the House website, you can figure out, if you just put in your address, your city and your state, you can figure out who is your congressman exactly, and then they have different phone numbers you can call. So sometimes people like to call about issues, for example, getting disability benefits. The D.C. office can't exactly help with that. We're not as built to doing that. We're built more so for, you know, taking meetings, scheduling meetings for the congressman. But other issues like disabilities, for example, the district office is actually the office that handles those issues. So you should know, depending on your concerns, sometimes the district office is better equipped to handle that, and other times the D.C. office is better equipped to handle
that. Right. So sometimes you should call the folks in Illinois as opposed to the people in Washington.
Yes.
Keith, I wonder what calls stand out to you, because you're taking all these calls all day. Which ones do you remember?
So the phone calls I remember the most are when constituents are yelling. And so, take an example from my first day.
So is your advice to maybe not yell at the intern answering the phone?
Yeah, so one advice is not to yell. And actually, you know what you're calling about. A lot of people call and they don't really know what they're calling about. They just want somebody to listen to them yell. And as an intern, you know, it's okay for me to sit there and listen. But at a certain point, you know, you have to realize that we are an office and we're getting many other phone calls as well. It is a constituent. We have to listen. But also, you know, just making sure, like, when you call, you have everything you want to say in a short period of time.
I'm speaking with Ajay Jain and Keith Jones. They're U of I juniors who are interning on Capitol Hill. And we also have Austin Stottleman and Millie Johnson with us. So, Millie, I understand you're working at a lobbying firm, Peck, Madigan, Jones. What do you guys lobby for?
They lobby for a variety of issues, but some of the prominent ones are healthcare and cyber. And then also there's quite a few lobbyists who focus their work on specifically on the Hill with representatives.
And did you specifically pick, Millie, that you wanted to work at a lobbying firm?
No, I applied to like a bunch of different positions, but the lobbying firm was interesting to me because I never really thought about interning for a lobbying firm. And the idea of having kind of this overlap between the public and the private sector was really interesting to me. So that was mostly my reasoning for choosing the lobbying firm.
Austin, you're working at the Democratic National Committee. What kind of things have you been learning about?
Yeah, so at the DNC, I am interning in the finance department. So the things that I kind of revolve around are more of fundraising and that sort of things, helping, you know, make Tom Perez's job easier to attract people to the party and progress the Democratic Party forward on a platform.
And is it interesting to do that on this year in 2019? Are you thinking, because I think a lot of people aren't necessarily thinking about fundraising now ahead of 2020.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the first things I learned is that it doesn't stop. You know, election cycles are every 2 years, but when you're actually in the game, it never stops. You keep going, you keep planning, you keep moving forward. And so learning that kind of routine has been very interesting. It makes you understand what people are doing off, you know, the cameras when they're all in your face in November and March for Illinois primaries and whatnot, and really seeing that aspect of the political field.
I wonder for you guys how all of you and everyone jump in here, how you feel like you're, I wonder, first of all, what your conception, how many of you had been to Washington or spent time in Washington before this semester? Any of you guys?
I spent a couple of days here, like just touring around. But this is definitely the first time I've actually lived outside of Illinois. It's been a very interesting experience for me.
And Millie, how about you? Have you spent a lot of time in Washington?
I've spent a week here over
like school trips,
like a holiday with my family.
Keith, how about you?
Same. I spent a week here vacationing with the family.
Austin?
Yep, same. Couple days back in 2014, just kind of went around to see all the important national structures and monuments and whatnot.
And so how do you think this time, so you guys have been here for a month, and you've been here in kind of a crazy month because there's been a federal government, the longest shutdown that has ever happened. How do you think your time has changed your view of Washington? Ajay?
A lot of people have this opinion about people in Washington, D.C., about, you know, bureaucrats and politicians and their staffers, that they don't work hard, that their interests aren't for their constituents, but rather for big companies and corporations. And to me, I've kind of realized that that view is just wrong in a way. I feel like, you know, the congressmen and the staff are just working constantly. They're always working for their constituents' interests and taking meetings with constituents and various groups from the district as well. So I think for me, you know, they're all, the congressmen and their staff are always working. And that's something that I was surprised to see a little bit, because, you know, this view people in Washington, D.C. is they're not working that much. People think that they're not working, and that's kind of not the case at all.
Keith, do you agree?
I agree. You know, before coming to the Hill, I thought, you know, you work 9 to 6 and that's it. But seeing behind the scenes, you know, it's actually a 24/7 job. You know, phone rings in the middle of the night, something big happened with the government. You got to, you know, prepare for the next day. Like, okay, like what does that have to do to prepare, like, statements and things like that? And so that's one thing I definitely did not realize. Like, the job just doesn't stop when you leave the building. It's just a 24/7 cycle that is fun to many, but it's also stressful as well.
Millie, has this changed your opinion of Washington, your time here?
I think it's really challenged the perspective that is kind of perpetuated about people in BC being, or in DC being for their interests and not for the public, because I feel like everybody I've met here, whether it was with Congressman Chinkas last week or just the lobbyists in my office or anybody on the street, everybody seems to be very friendly, which I feel like challenges the kind of perspective most people have about DC.
I've been speaking with students from the U of I who were here in Washington for this semester, Ajay Jain, Keith Jones, Austin Stottleman, and Millie Johnson. And I wanted to welcome Andrea Mayer. She's the director of the U of I's Illinois and Washington program, and she also teaches political science courses here in D.C. Hi, Andrea. Thanks for being here with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
So I wonder, as we're hearing the students share their experiences, what your goal is as the person who organizes and brings students here every semester, and they're just here for a semester. So what do you hope they get out of it?
Well, the Illinois and Washington is sort of an opportunity for students to come to Washington, D.C. They all come, they all intern all over. They intern on the Hill, but a lot of different places. We have STEM students come. We have students from a variety of backgrounds. And my argument is always that there's a job for everybody in D.C. Anything that interests you, there's somebody who's working on that issue in Washington, D.C. And so coming to D.C. is that opportunity for experiential learning, where you apply things that you've already learned in your classrooms. You get to sort of test conventional wisdom about, you know, how is politics working? How is our democracy working? So I think the reason the university feels strongly about supporting experiential learning is that experiential learning helps you apply what you've learned in the classroom. It certainly helps you get a job after college, but it also helps you sort of learn a little bit more and explore larger questions about how is our democracy working and what role do I want to play in moving forward with my career.
And so I wonder if you feel like students come away feeling inspired about our democracy, cynical, somewhere in between?
Yeah, sometimes we notice that, you know, when they first get here, maybe there's a very sort of fast journey to that point where they feel like, oh, gosh, that, you know, there seems to be a lot of inefficiency that I'm observing. But then once the students get involved in their internships and they're given more substantive work and they start to realize how people, you know, cross the aisle politically and how people work together on projects, I think that sort of enthusiasm comes back. I think most of the students feel pretty hopeful by the time they're done the program because they've been part of important projects. They've made a difference. And many of the students talk about their time in Washington, D.C. as sort of a life-changing experience. In other words, it may not set the direction for the rest of their life, but it's probably a pivot in some way. It's probably a moment where they can take a look at, you know, the democratic process and activism and public policy and find their way forward. And so I think most students end up feeling pretty enthusiastic once they leave.
That's Andrea Mayer, who's the director of the Illinois and Washington program. I wonder if I could just ask all of you guys really quickly about just that on that one last question. How is, if you feel optimistic or how being here has made you feel about our democratic system? Austin?
I would say that it hasn't necessarily changed my view of our democratic system. Obviously, you know, our, you know, constitutional republic has its benefits to society, and obviously its, you know, flaws are very talked about in modern day, you know, discussion. But it hasn't really, my experience here has made me more eager, if anything, to become a part of that and to help make it better, as opposed to having some sort of revealed criticism or, you know, has revealed some sort of dysfunction that I just wasn't previously, you know, aware of that would make me more narcissistic about it.
Keith?
Being in D.C. so far has actually inspired me to become part of politics one day.
You know, and do you want to become a politician?
One day, hopefully so. You know, later in my career, you know, I have to start small now, but eventually at some point in my career, I do want to become a politician.
You want Bobby Rush's seat?
And so, but coming out of the program, you know, it's giving me a deeper meaning into what politics actually is. Cause, you know, behind this, like, you never know, like, what goes on behind closed doors, and actually being able to sit behind those closed doors and see, like, what's actually happening. Cause you look on TV, you would think, like, oh, it's a big divide between, you know, the aisles. It's really not. You know, it's business is business. And then after business is done, you know, you still have your relationships after that. And so that's one thing I really look forward to, like, those fights and in the rooms, but after we come out with a solution, you know, it's all friendly after that.
Millie?
The first week here was hard for me because every day when I go to work, I take the Metro. And when you go to Union Station and you walk by, outside of Metro Station, there's just so many homeless people. And the first week here, it was really cold. We just had the huge cold snap. And that was something that was really hard for me to go to work and sit at a desk all day, kind of working to research big company interests when I'm walking home and I see all these people who like need a place to stay. And so that was one of the hardest things, I think, coming for me. But as I've been here longer, on Fridays when we go and meet with congressmen or do different activities, it's really kind of changed my idea to like see what's going on behind the scenes. And there are things that are happening to just like better the lives and the welfare, and that people in general do have the best idea in mind for
how
other
to fix
people.
Things like
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Ajay?
I do feel more optimistic about the democratic process here, and I also agree with, you know, Keith and Austin. I'm definitely more eager about, you know, becoming a politician and potentially entering politics. One of the things that I thought that was really interesting was that the amount of bipartisanship that happens. You know, we have a lot of headlines on CNN and on about, you know, Democrats and Republicans fighting the Trump administration versus the U.S. House of Representatives, for example, you know, the government shutdown. But a lot of it, you know, I got to meet representatives from both sides of the aisle. I've seen Congressman Krishnamoorthy talk in meetings with various organizations. And I also got to meet Congressman Shimkus and Congressman Bobby Rush as well. And the one thing that I noticed about all three of these representatives is that not only are they very nice people, and they both have the interests, they all have the interests of their constituents at heart, but they also work together a lot on bipartisan bills, for example. So, for example, Congressman Krishnamoorthy, he had some legislation that he just passed in the last session of Congress that aims to expand funding for apprenticeships and skills-based education so companies can better adapt and better hire new recruits may have not necessarily graduated college, for example. And Congressman Shimkus and Bobby Rush also had similar pieces of legislation where they were bipartisan pieces, where they worked across the aisle to get things done. And I think that's something that, you know, being here in Washington, D.C. and observing firsthand is something that makes me extremely hopeful for the years to come.
So I want to thank all of you for being here. Ajay Jain, you just heard from Keith Jones, Millie Johnson, Austin Stottleman are all students at the University of Illinois, and Andrea Mayer is director of the Illinois and Washington program. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Up after the break, Lauren Schiller is a photojournalist who took some of the most well-known pictures of President John F. Kennedy. And on this President's Day, we'll hear from him about a new exhibit featuring JFK's life. It's actually at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and it's called American Visionary. Stay close, you're listening to The 21st. That's coming up next. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A new exhibit tracing President John F. Kennedy's life from his boyhood to the presidency opened this past weekend at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Called American Visionary, it not only features iconic images from JFK's life, but also puts the president of Camelot in context with our state's own great president, Lincoln. Joining me now is the Director of Communication and Public Affairs from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, Chris Wills, and the curator of the exhibit, director, photographer, and writer, Larry Schiller. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me aboard.
I am of a generation of Americans, and there are quite a few of us who only know this event through photographs. When this was happening, I guess it's not something you were thinking about at the time, how historic these images would end up being sort of seared into our national consciousness.
Well, none of us realized that we were heading into some very, very difficult times. In the end result, at the 60s, we would have 5 assassinations in America. So the first 2 or 3 years of the Kennedy administration, which is depicted in what I call the golden age of photojournalism, is almost a window into the future of that decade, because you have everything from the failure of the Bay of Pigs, everything from civil rights that was starting to come into the consciousness of America, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy running off to Europe to meet with Khrushchev. It was a very, very interesting window. We didn't realize we were looking through a window for a wild, wild west, but we were.
What was it like to return to that time as you were putting this exhibit together?
Well, I actually covered Nixon's campaign for the presidency, and it was an exciting period because you really had a feeling of youth emerging out, coming out of the Eisenhower era, which was a very, very serious era. Eisenhower represented the success in Europe in World War II. America was getting back on its feet. It was an exciting period of what is the future going to hold?
We're speaking with Larry Schiller. We're talking about the photographs that he took that are part of a new exhibition at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. This is an exhibit that's traveled all across the country. Chris Wills is with us from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Chris, I wonder how you think the viewing experience changes for people seeing images of President Kennedy. These are images all the way, as I said, there's the campaign trail, there's a boyhood, there's his presidency, as well as the assassination. What's it like to see this at the museum of another president, Abraham Lincoln?
Well, I think it has to add layers of significance to what you're seeing. The photos of Kennedy and his family and friends are touching by themselves. But when you add to that the layer of another assassination kind of in the background, when you have Lincoln's assassination hanging there as well, it makes it more, to me anyway, a look at America's problems and violence. It becomes not just the tragic story of Camelot, but a kind of a larger question of why does this happen in America, and are we learning anything as the decades go by?
Mm. You know, what was interesting to me, and I was really happy that the exhibit was going to be shown at the Abraham Lincoln Library, and it was great that it opened a couple days ago. What interested me was that, you know, Kennedy was a great orator. He really captured people with his speech, and so was Lincoln. We know, of course, the great Gettysburg Address, but if you look at Lincoln's other speeches, they were really concise and to the point. He got a lot done through his form of communication, as Kennedy did. As was just pointed out, both their lives were cut short. The interesting thing is that we know what type of a president Lincoln was, emancipation and everything else. We don't know what type of a president Kennedy would have been. That's really the interesting thing, because his presidency had not really shown any great results, where Lincoln's presidency showed results right down almost every year.
And it's interesting that you say that, Larry, because I think there is sort of this whole mythology surrounding Camelot and the presidency and JFK as a president. Chris, the Library and Museum is actually hosting a special event tomorrow evening to sort out some of these connections, the fact from the fiction. I wonder what other similarities you all see in terms of, and what other myths, like what other things you think have been overblown?
Well, I think probably we've all seen these lists that circulate online about the eerie parallels between Kennedy and Lincoln. Both served in Congress and later were president. They were elected in 1860 and 1960. Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy. Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln. But not all of that is true. Even some of the true stuff is overblown and just kind of a meaningless coincidence. So this event, Fact versus Fiction, is meant to be somewhat lighthearted look at how much of that really holds up. I think there's a lot to think about in the connections between Kennedy and Lincoln that are much more significant than dates and numbers of letters in their name. Their roles in civil rights, the assassinations, the communications skills, as Larry pointed out, those are meaningful parallels. The stuff that gets shared and on the internet is not.
If we think about how photogenic John F. Kennedy, his wife, if we think about the First Lady, we think about how telegenic they were, how much that was part of their presence. And I imagine that was also, Chris, a little bit of a difference because Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln, that was not really part of campaigning.
Correct. I mean, for instance, there are no pictures of Lincoln with his wife. They certainly didn't present themselves as a couple the way that John Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy did. But Lincoln knew the value of photographs. He used photographs to project an image in a way that no president before him did. So he and Kennedy certainly had some of those skills and talents in common.
I wonder if we could talk about some of the photographs that are in this exhibit. Larry, as I mentioned at the beginning, there's some famous, iconic images that people associate with President Kennedy. Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, number one, he was such a youthful president that it attracted crowds. He was really a very, very attractive young man. And his father said to him at one point, if you can bring together the female vote, women in America, you'll win this election. And there are some pictures where you see hundreds and hundreds of women just lined up, and there's not a man in the crowd to meet JFK. And then you go into the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I have a couple photographs, because I was working for Life magazine at that time, of the effect of the scare. This first time the America really had the scare of the A-bomb. And I photographed kids lining up in the hallways in their schools, crouched in positions or hiding under desks. So the Cuban Missile Crisis is shown there in many, many examples. And of course, when Kennedy, you know, stood up to Khrushchev and eventually went first to Vienna and then Paris, really the ambassador from the United States is Jacqueline Kennedy, because Kennedy makes this famous remark in France that he's very happy to accompany the true real spokesman for the U.S., Jackie Kennedy. And of course, the crowd goes crazy because she speaks fluent French. But the pictures really show the conflict, the problems. You see him at the Berlin Wall, and you see him on national television, and yet you see him at, you know, 10 o'clock at night walking his son, who's about, 3 years old, to bed. That says it all, this picture. And, of course, the wonderful pictures of Caroline running around the White House, the West Wing, with her dolls. The pictures, you know, step by step take you through the hills and the valleys of the presidency. And of course, there's a very interesting picture there where Jacqueline Kennedy was wearing this powdered pink suit. And of course, 2 years later, her husband is assassinated and blood is sprayed all over that suit as they drove through Dealey Plaza. So those two photographs, almost a year and a half, 2 years apart, are really interesting because, as many people know, Jacqueline rarely wore the same dress twice.
Mm. Larry, as you have mentioned a couple of times, your background as a photojournalist, you worked for a different media outlets through many administrations. I'm wondering how you think the climate has changed for photojournalists, especially covering the president today.
Well, on the second floor of the Dallas police station, when Lee Harvey Oswald was captured, there was one television camera that weighed about 600 pounds at the end of the hallway. It was the first live broadcast in the United States and around the world of an event to the world. They became, the television networks became the educator of the world. By the time you get up into 2000, Apple and the Android phones with their cameras in it are the journalists of today. Every single person with a phone is a photojournalist.
We've been learning about President Kennedy and President Lincoln on this President's Day. We'll have info on the exhibit. It's called American Visionary, John F. Kennedy's Life and Times. We'll have that up at our website at 21stshow.org. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
The Chicago suburb of Aurora is mourning the deaths of five people who were shot and killed on Friday. Trevor Wayner, Clayton Parks, Vicente Juarez, Josh Pinkard, and Russell Beyer. They were killed by a sixth person, gunman Gary Martin, who was then shot and killed by police. Six police officers were also injured. Just one remains in the hospital. Yesterday, hundreds gathered for a vigil in the freezing rain to honor lives lost and pray for their community. Steve Lord and Megan Jones have been in Aurora this weekend. They're both reporters at the Beacon News. Steve, Megan, thanks for making the time to be with us this morning.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you.
Steve, this is such a difficult thing for a community to go through. There's so many places in the country, unfortunately, that have had to go through this. I just want to start by asking how Aurora is doing this Monday morning.
Well, you know, Aurora has experienced its share of violence over the years. And especially over the last, say, 30-some years, certainly they're not used to something like this. But I think it was said best by a prominent businessman of theirs yesterday who was at the vigil. He said, Aurora has a big heart, and your heart just really goes out to the people we lost. People who are longtime Aurorans are very proud of that fact, and they stick up for their town. And I think they also rally around, in situations like this. And it has shown in how the city has rallied over time to address the problems it has and it deals with. So I think that they're probably, everyone's sad, everyone's shocked, but I think there's also a rally around our town mentality.
Megan, police have been saying that the gunman should not have had a firearm in the first place. Why are they saying that?
A lot of questions remain right now about how he had kept his gun, that he wasn't legally allowed to carry. He had applied for a FOID card back in January 2014. That was approved, and he bought a gun a couple months later. Then he applied for a concealed carry license, and during that background check, authorities found that he had a previous felony conviction for aggravated assault out in Mississippi, and somehow the FOID card application missed that. So the Illinois State Police revoked his FOID card. They rejected his concealed carry application. State police normally would have sent a letter to Martin letting him know it was revoked and telling him to give up the weapon to his local police agency, but it's unclear right now if Martin had received that letter from Illinois State Police, and that's something that police are still really investigating as to why he never gave up the gun and how this system kind of works of who's checking up on these people after they get letters like that.
I'm sure those are good questions people will be asking. Steve, Megan, what can you tell us about the five people who died on Friday?
Well, Trevor, he was a college student from Northern Illinois University, and this was his first day on the job as an intern. He was hoping to go into HR, and his dad said he was doing exactly what he loved that day. Vicente Juarez, he was the family patriarch, taking care of his three children and his eight grandchildren. Clayton Parks was a husband. He was a father to a very young son. He was the human resources director at Pratt. Josh Pinkard was a father of three. He loved Mississippi sports, and he had texted his wife during the shooting that day to actually say, "I love you. I've been shot." And then Russell, he was the union chairman, and according to his GoFundMe page, he had actually helped Martin try to keep his job on several occasions. So I think our heart just goes out to all of them. They were in that meeting at the time. Three were shot and killed inside the meeting, and then two others were killed somewhere within the warehouse.
Well, thanks for sharing those details with us. As we remember, it's really heartbreaking just to hear about those lives that were lost. And Steve, as you said, this is something I know you all will continue to follow at the Beacon News as we see how Aurora continues to recover from this. Steve Lord is a reporter with the Beacon News. Megan Jones is also with the Beacon News. Steve, Megan, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We'll see you back here tomorrow.